friends, we are beginning a series of five discussions to deal with the concept of the bodies of man in Indian philosophy. It is a most intriguing problem, and one about which, of course, we cannot exhaust the existing knowledge. But perhaps a somewhat more adequate understanding of the relationships between the various parts of the compound which we call man will have practical utility in helping us to organize and integrate a practical and vital philosophy of life. So we will begin with the physical body, which in religion, of course, has been very largely neglected. To the average person, the physical body becomes a symbol, per se, of materiality. Yet this by no means exhausts the symbolism involved. We think of things physical and things material as identical. Actually, the physical world in which we live and the physical body, which is our own peculiar and personal dwelling place, these are not materialistic things in our use of the term. Perhaps it would be better to say that the physical body of man is a mudra, which means a seal. It is a kind of strange and mysterious design. It is the extension of energies and principles into corporeal structure. And the body itself is a strange and wonderful picture of the entire process of creation. This led the medieval alchemists to say that the supreme power in its wisdom had given man three books to study: the universe, Holy Writ, and the human body. All three of these should be subjected to understanding, to analysis, to consideration, not merely for their own sakes, but for the sake of truth, and for the sake of the mysteries which are locked in them, and which can best be discovered through a thoughtful and careful analysis of bodily structure. In the human body, man has one of the most intricate designs and structures which it is possible for him to examine. He has one tremendous advantage also, for in the study of the body, he is studying something intimate to himself, something which he inhabits. And who can understand a house better than the man who lives in it? And in what direction can he turn in search of instruction, which is more direct, more personal, more intimate, more inevitably brought to his consideration than this corporeal organization in which he dwells? Many times we realize how apt the parallel is between the human body and an automobile. For in the study of man, we find that the human compound, as an archetypal design, is reflected into everything that man does. And there is no construction which he has ever devised which he has not taken from nature. And nearly every important advancement in science has come as the result of man's study of himself and of the tremendous and wonderful organization which exists within him. An organization which teaches him government, teaches him science, art, and gives him the rudimentary principles of philosophy. In the case of the automobile, we have several very useful parallels. First of all, we have the physical structure of the machine, a structure which is improved as rapidly as man's ingenuity permits. Sometimes, like the human body, it is not improved, it is merely complicated by what we term progress. But assuming that a machine is well built, suitable to the purpose for which it was intended, it stands before us, a glittering, inanimate thing, of itself incapable of motion, incapable of any activity except existing. And this is the primary state of the human body. So we must support this device, we must animate it, we must bring out its purposeful utilities by various further contributions. First of all, the automobile must have fuel. And in a combustion engine, there must be both fuel and air. And in the case of man, fuel and air are represented by nutrition and respiration. And if these are added to the car, we then have a potentially movable thing. But it still stands still, because this is not enough. So we must add to this also an electrical circuit. And an electrical circuit corresponds in the car to the distribution of the tactic energies in the human body. By means of a constant motion of energy, we are able to fulfill the reasonable expectancies of a combustion motor. So now we have a motor still more capable of action, but still doing nothing. So to these others, we must add something which the man in your service station will forever bring to your attention. And that is that if you want your car to last a long time, you must be sure to keep it lubricated. So we have a lubricational factor. And lubrication, in this case, means the distribution of oil. And the purpose of this oil is to reduce the friction of moving parts. From the very beginning of time, oil has had a tremendous symbolical meaning. Melchizedek, the priest of Salem, anointed the patriarch's head with oil. The oil of baptism, the oil of salvation, had the same meaning long ago that it has now. For the purpose of it in your car is to save the car, to keep it from wearing out before its time, to preserve the fine adjustments, and to coat all these moving parts with a protective covering. Now, in the human body, we have the same procedures carried on through the secretional functions within the body itself. And we also are reminded of this mysterious power of grace, a strange intersection of a principle of salvation, which is as important to man as it is to the maintenance of his car. So now we have everything, but the car stands just exactly where it stood in the first place, because the one thing is now lacking, without which the invention itself is a wonderful but meaningless thing. And that's the man who owns one. In other words, the driver. The person who uses the car. It is the person who stops and starts it. It is the person who employs it to carry him to his various destinations. And this car can cause in the person a number of very interesting psychological reactions. To a great many very humble, rather unimportant, drab personalities, an automobile is power. It is a wonderful opportunity to go down the road at a tremendous rate of speed, make other people get out of your way. A car also is something. The first few days you have it, you polish it carefully and then proceed to neglect it completely. The only difference is, of course, with the body, you have to wait quite a while before you can turn it in on a new model. But the individual with the car may be going somewhere and he may be going nowhere. He may need it in his business. He may need it for his pleasure. It may be called into service for many purposes, but the man who drives the car is the master of it. And it exists for his use. It exists to accomplish the purpose of his mind or his emotions. This car has no will of its own, no purpose of its own, no destiny of its own except the junkie. In this case, in man, that he shall join his ancestors in the sleep of the earth. This car is meaningful because of the mind that makes use of it. And here we have so many parallels and so many philosophical implications, you can extend them almost indefinitely. But the major point that we have to analyze is that no matter how perfectly the body may operate, or how healthy it may be, how brand new and shiny like this year's model of an automobile, the car is only really important because of the use that is made of it. It is only valuable because man needs it. And if man did not need it, it would disappear forever from the earth. In the study of the human body, therefore, we know that it was called a vehan, or vehicle, the horse upon which the rider rides, or the chariot in which he is drawn, or the wagon, the vehicle of a living, conscious being. We would never for a moment acknowledge the probability or possibility that the automobile and the man who drives it, these two are one. We would never want to assume that the driver could be mistaken for the car, or the car be mistaken for the driver. Yet in studying man, we constantly make this mistake. We have not yet learned to understand that all physical things are alive only because of a life that is imparted to them. Each naturally has its own basic life. Even an automobile has a basic life. The very elements of which it is composed, if we could magnify them and study them sufficiently, each of these minute atoms or electrons is a living thing. But the significance of the car is due to the organizing power of a more highly evolved life that uses it. And it is the same in the compound of man. This human body which we have is valuable to us because it is a means of our journey. It is the way in which we travel out of the past into the present and forward to the future. It is our link with objectivity, with the universe of phenomena around us. It is our means of growth. For not only can we express ourselves through the instrument of the body, but through the sensitivity of the sensory perceptions of the body, we can take into ourselves experience, understanding. We can observe and find the subject for reflection and contemplation. Thus the body is our connection, a bridge upon which traffic moves two ways, by which the individual moves out into manifestation, and by which the manifested universe moves into the individual for comprehension, to be known, to be analyzed, to be considered. Therefore, the body, like a good machine, is very valuable to us. And very few persons would consider giving as little thought and attention to their automobile as they do to their bodies. Very few would be satisfied to permit their bodies to pass into premature desuetude. If this body was appreciated and known as we appreciate and know an automobile. So we have this basic concept now of the body and the person in it. And this evening we are to deal principally with the body itself, how we can learn from it and what we can learn from it. To realize that it is not good or bad any more than an automobile is good or bad. If there is an accident, we do not usually blame the automobile. Or if we do, it is because of defective parts, often due to neglect. actually a serious traffic violation is accredited to the driver, where the difficulty properly belongs. In the same way, the body, about which we have many negative legends, is scarcely ever responsible for the unfortunate publicity which it receives. It is the person misusing or abusing the body which is the result of nearly all difficulties through which the body passes. Knowing the body itself to be composed of certain basic materials, depending for their usefulness and their animation upon a vital energy moving through them, we see that the body is sustained and maintained primarily by internal energy. This internal energy is said to exist as a great stream of power, a universal electrical system, and within man there are certain poles by means of which universal energy can be captured, and as a stream of light flow into the body, where it is differentiated into five important streams, which are called tattvas. Of these, the fifth contains the other four, and the four flowing out of the fifth are like the rivers that flowed in the ancient story of Eden, the four rivers that water the world. And these rivers of energy flowing into the body, animating it, preserving it, and protecting it, giving purpose and meaning to its functions, and maintaining the eternal process of generation perpetually going on within the body structure itself. These streams of life, under normal conditions, can and do preserve and protect the body against sickness, against malfunction of any kind, and against premature destruction or wearing out of the body. Now, energy is a more or less irresistible force, and the body is a vast receptacle, like a reservoir, into which this energy flows, and through which it is distributed by the intricate systems of nerves, veins, arteries, lymphatics, glandular structures, etc. These distributions allow energy to reach all parts of the bodily structure, and this energy is interpreted in each area according to the needs and requirements of that area, so that, as the Hindu points out, each of the nerve filaments of the human nervous system end in a figure of a deity, for the termination of every nerve is in some little area of life, and in that area, that nerve is God, maintaining, preserving, vitalizing, most of all, giving the spark of light, like the spark of electricity from the battery in the automobile. If then, energy is this irresistible force, most difficulties of the body arise from the impeding of energy flow. Wherever energy meets obstruction, there is conflict. And if the energy is unable to overcome the obstruction, then we have the natural ground of pathology. For nearly all pathology begins or originates in interference with the natural circulation of life. The moment we, one way or another, divide life from itself, isolate it, cause it to lose its root, which is in the common life, if we kill the root, ultimately the whole plant or tree will die. Also, if for one reason or another, we injure a branch or part of the tree, then this will die, unless the injury is not too severe. If it is repairable, nature will repair it. So we may say, generally speaking, that most sickness that can come to man is the result of obstruction to the natural motion, process, and function of the body. Now, the body, we may say, can, under certain conditions, develop such interferences and such obstructions of itself. This is not common, however, except when the body has worn a long time and has been subject to a considerable amount of abuse. Normally speaking, the obstructions which are liable to damage the body are either accidental, due to circumstances about which the individual may have no control, or they are the result of disobedience to the rules and regulations relating to body. Now, if body is only a machine, it is very much like a machine in another way, namely, that a machine is no device about which we can hold abstract, sentimental attitudes if we expect it to run. If the car breaks down, no amount of argument will start it again, nor will any prayers addressed to abstract space be likely to take the place of a burned-out bearing. Also, we will observe that platitudes do very little good, and the general advice of an individual who knows nothing about motors is also seldom effective. When the body of the car, or when the motor of the car, becomes ill, there's only one thing to do, and that is take it to an expert and hope he is as expert as he should be. Now, in connection with problems relating to the body, as in mechanics, these problems relate to immutable laws. There are right and wrong ways of doing everything. The wrong way will always end in trouble, and the right way will prevent the trouble or perhaps assist in its correction. But there is no possible way of neglecting the car without ultimately regretting it, and there is no way of neglecting the body with any better fortune. So with the body, as with all things in the material world, we are working with exactitudes. Now, granted, man does not understand all of these, and a great part of the mystery of the body remains unsolved. But we have every reason to believe from past experience that when it is solved, it will be lawful, that it will represent absolute and exact principles, and that the skillful use of knowledge is the only way by means of which the body can be maintained, just as it is the only way in which the car can be repaired. Thus, from all physical things, the body, the world around us, the world within us for that matter, we learn one of our first great lessons, as the Hindus have pointed out, namely that we are living in a world of exactitudes, and that in this world there is no substitute for essential knowledge, that all the well-wishing and the good-hoping in the world will not take the place of facts. Man, of his own will and accord, does not like to face facts. He would like to live in a fairyland, a world of miracles. But the material universe teaches him that there is only one complete and inscrutable miracle, and that is the total of existence itself. The mystery of it is beyond his comprehension. But wherever he does understand, the miracle disappears and law and order takes its place. And what we call a miracle is a scientific process or a fact, the cause, means, ultimate of which we may not understand. But there are no miracles in the universe. There is only law unfolding. And those who understand and obey achieve those securities which appear miraculous to the uninformed. So from the physical world we learn the importance of law and order, and of the integration of our resources, and of the organizing of the bodily problem. Now, the body, being a very useful instrument, we must give it some attention. For while it is wonderfully and strangely strong, it is also wonderfully and strangely weak. The body can stand a tremendous amount of abuse, but then it may suddenly break. It can stand a great deal of one kind of strain and very little of another. And each human being has to learn to know what his body can do, how much of it he can afford to expend in terms of energy, motion, effort, time, strength. Failure to understand the body and to recognize its proper rights and privileges will again lead to the destruction of its utility. And if the body is damaged beyond a certain point, this house, this palace of man's purpose becomes his dungeon and his prison. So the purpose is always to preserve the distribution of energies and to prevent obstructions, to prevent the building of tensions and stresses by which the body will be subjected to an unreasonable strain. Realizing that energy moving from its own roots and source within and behind man, and flowing through his body as activity and as sensation and perception and as all these different qualities, that this energy may be blocked or may be impaired, will cause us to pause and wonder why and how. One of the most important realizations that we have, and we're gradually developing a scientific proof of a philosophic statement, is that the greatest killer in the world is tension. The reason that tension kills is because tension locks processes, because it prevents the free and normal distribution of energy. Wherever there is tension, the bodily energies are damaged, or perhaps more completely, the means of their distribution is damaged. Thus, tension is not in the body, but is contributed to the body by the driver. And it very often happens that the driver, because he is nervous, excited, unreasonable, careless, may wreck his car. This happens every day with human bodies. And the majority of sickness is due to the same kind of causes that will wreck an automobile. One of the major causes, perhaps, for man is his failure to recognize his responsibility to his body. Bodies, in a funny way, are like children. We either treat them so badly and neglect them so horribly that we repent, or else we spoil them hopelessly. Moderation seems a virtue we know little of. And in the case of the body, the moment we permit it to become the master of our living, it is an inanimate mechanical tyrant. It is like an automobile that may dime us and dollar us to death, until we become an absolute servant of trying to maintain the payments on a car that is too expensive for us. On the other hand, to neglect this body, to fail to keep it in order, is also to be punished, to suffer the consequences of neglect or indifference. Thus we find that in terms of philosophy and in terms of ethics, the body is not a principle. It is an opportunity and an object lesson. The body is one of man's opportunities to be intelligent. It is a present and insistent demand upon him for reasonable care, thoughtfulness, intelligence. And the body, of course, that is best treated is the one which, because it is never abused nor spoiled, forms a very slight equation in our way of life. Gradually, through the moderation of our attitudes and habits, we bring the body to efficiency, if we so desire. And while it serves in this efficient capacity, we hardly know we have one. It's like an appendix. We do not know that's there till we lose it. And in the body, we do not realize our dependence upon it until it begins to reveal in distemper of some kind. The body is then in Indian philosophy, not a principle, not a thing regarded as living in itself, but as something upon which life is focused, and through which, as through a magnifying glass, its rays are concentrated and then diffused. So the body is a material focal point. It is our link with external things, and it is also our ever-present and immediate lesson. Now, there may be reasons under certain conditions why the body may be neglected for some other reason or purpose that is considered more important. But anyone making this decision must abide by it. For if he neglects the body, his motive is of no biological interest. His motive may be like that of the martyr, who cheerfully allows his body to be burned at the stake rather than to compromise his ideals and principles. But his heroic decision does not prevent his body from being burned. And while it may be that under certain conditions we are forced, in the cause of some greater purpose, to neglect the body, we must not do this without full realization that our decision involves moral responsibility. If we neglect, we must do so fully accepting the burden or the limitations which will result from such neglect. The belief that because our cause is just or our purposes are good, we will not be forced to meet the debts of nature, this belief is unsound. The solution lies not on this level, but on the level of decision, in which, fully knowing what we are doing, we are resolved to accomplish a greater good and are willing to pay the penalty for accomplishing that good. Thus, the body teaches us its own inflexible requirements, and there can be no escape from them. In Indian philosophy, the body has certain inalienable rights, for it corresponds very closely to the lowest caste in the Indian caste system, namely the caste of the Sudra, or the slave. And the Indian recognized the body primarily as a servant, the purpose of which was to contribute to the function and security of the Brahman, the higher caste which abides within the body. The body, therefore, has its laws and its rules. We never transcend them but by keeping them. And in the yogic disciplines, the body plays a subtle but very important part. For it was the belief of these ancient teachers that the mystery of the body is man's first initiation into the mystery of God. If man cannot guard and keep his body through the conscious dedication of his attention, he will never be able to proceed to other things. Therefore, in the mysteries of the old religions, growth was not through the neglect of body, but through the attainment of a superior state above body, a state, however, that was not attained at the sacrifice of body, but rather through the fulfillment of its rules and regulations. It would take hundreds of textbooks to reveal all the symbolism, moral, ethical, spiritual, social, contained within the body. For in it is every system of government, every principle of mathematics, astronomy, music, art, literature. All these principles abide within man and have their parallels and their correspondences in the structure and function of his material form. Yet man does not stop there. He goes on. But he should always be mindful of the idea that only those who are faithful unto little things can be made masters over greater things. And the first little thing about which we must be faithful is this carcass of ours, which we are so often inclined to overlook. I know too many people interested in various abstract subjects who would gladly leave the body behind in their race for enlightenment. But they're going to need it all the way, because the beginning of their enlightenment, the beginning of all enlightenment, is what is called attention. The ability of the individual to give unto all problems and subjects that attention that is due and proper to them. No man will grow by neglect. No individual will become more secure because he runs away from a lesser responsibility in the search of a greater one. The responsibility on every man's doorstep is his own body. This does not necessarily mean that he must spend the rest of his life catering to it. Because as Plato once said about the handsome Alcibiades, there is very little use of being a golden dagger, a leaden dagger in a golden sheath. And that the spirit of man should be asleep and the body handsome and strong is not the end of wisdom either. But by a certain knowledge of the body, through a certain study of its laws and rules, man gradually gains a comprehension of the principles behind body. So we now have a new parallel which we have to establish, and that is the parallel between the body of man and the material or visible universe in total. Man's body was termed in the Middle Ages a microcosm, or a miniature of the universe. The greater body, the body of the universe, was called a macrocosm. And these, according to the Hermetic analogy, were bound together by similarities. As above, so below. As in the greater, so in the lesser. Man studying to solve the mystery of his own existence is rather a disadvantage when it comes to trying to solve the riddle of the universe. He cannot explore beyond the stars in space. He cannot examine all the vast mechanisms of the cosmos. They are too profound, too distant, too vast for his comprehension. Yet man does not need to, because he has present with him at all times a miniature of this whole process, a miniature in which every law of nature is present in some form or symbol, a miniature of processes, of means and of methods. And nearly all of the great philosophies of the past have been heavily indebted to anatomy and physiology for their abstract premises. And nearly all of the great religions of the world have patterned their creation myths from the generation myths of the human body. So religion, like all other branches of learning, is closely related to anatomy and physiology. And man seeking the larger answer does so by expanding the visible and possible knowledge which he can gain through the study of himself. Man, know thyself was written above the gates of the ancient temples, and this axiom still stands as one of the most important of all philosophical injunctions. By the neglect of it, man loses his perspective on larger problems. Now, when we analyze this body more carefully, we have already said that according to Hindu philosophy, it is not a principle. It is not a principle because it is not actually a self-motivating instrument. It is not a principle because, like the automobile, it must have a driver. The body is not self-moved. It is moved by other things which control and dominate it. It may therefore not be regarded as having a complete and separate subsistence in nature or in space. The principle of body is archetypal, it is universal. Every creature that comes into this world must have some kind of a form appropriate for its manifestation here. And body is always appropriate to the life which engenders it and which uses it as an instrument. Therefore, the evolution of species, the development of kinds, the various kingdoms of nature, the various worlds of kingdoms, of plants, minerals, animals, all of these differentiations are also symbolic statements about the degrees of life that are moving through them. For in the achievement of the compound objective personality of man, we find the full statement of man's attainment. We find, therefore, that the body is forever bearing witness to that which is within it. And from the study of the body, if we approach it correctly, we can approach a knowledge of the person in the body, the being by means of which this body is animated and sustained. Thus the body tells us, if we wish to examine it, much of the story of ourselves. We have spoken to you at various times on such subjects as physiognomy, phrenology, palmistry, and graphology, and other symbolic arts which men have devised because they were convinced that by means of the body, the nature of the self could be diagnosed. Now, obviously, as the Chinese have told us, such a diagnosis requires not a superficial investigation, but a very deep and profound analysis. It means that we must be observant of very slight and wonderfully sensitive symbols. And these again invite our attention, invite our serious and careful analysis. Man coming into contact with body and forming an alliance with it gets himself into a series of difficulties. Because in the beginning of his material life, consciousness seems to emerge from body or through body, and man under normal conditions does not have any consciousness of an unbodied state, it is almost inevitable that man should associate body with life and assume that that which is embodied is alive and that which is disembodied is dead. Furthermore, the individual, building upon this assumption, identifies the requirements of his consciousness with those of his body and assumes that if he serves the body, he serves himself. This has certain truth in it, but is not a complete truth, because the individual who unreasonably and excessively serves his body is usually at the same time doing an ill turn to himself. And all effort to identify body and being and to build a philosophy of life upon the assumption that they are one and the same, these will end in disaster. Usually this disaster will manifest on a psychological level because the individual has mistaken the machine for the man who operates it. Such a mistake can and often does bring with it a great deal of misery and result in a wrong diagnosis of problems and difficulties with which we are all confronted. One of the most simple, for example, of all of these problems is the aging of the body and the assumption that this means that the person is growing old. That is a very common identification. Someone says to you, how old are you? And you answer, 63. You are not 63, the body is. But it never occurs to differentiate between them. Someone says to you, is John a blonde or a brunette? We say he is a brunette. We are saying that his body is. But in our thinking, we do not make that subconscious differentiation. So whatever peculiarities may be manifested in the body, we assume that these peculiarities constitute the person. Now there is a reason why this assumption takes place. For the person in the body is in some way responsible for the fact that John is a brunette. The person in the body is in some way responsible for the attitudes or conditions which we associate with age. And while the person in the body is not 63 years old, the person in the body can enter into an hypnotic acceptance that it is 63 years old and can transfer this description of the body to its own nature and gradually begin to develop such symptoms of age as we psychologically would associate with those years. Gradually, as time goes on, we are beginning to attack this matter of assuming that the definition of the body is the definition of the being. We are becoming less and less interested in the physical term of age. We are beginning to agree that we are as old as we feel, and we do not wish to have things done for us or things done to us which remind us that we perhaps are a little past our best years. We prefer to live in the conviction that the thing inside does not grow old. This type of conviction can be very useful to us, because psychological aging is one of our great difficulties in living. And the individual who feels old is older than Methuselah, and the individual who does not feel old can be young at 90. Here is where the identification of body and being results in a distinct and definite loss. Another example where we have difficulty perhaps a little more serious, is the assumption, for instance, that a person who has a certain disease of the brain is insane. It is the body which does not function. It is not the person who is insane. But we do not differentiate between them. And because we have mistaken an injury or obstruction in the brain structure and have interpreted it as an indication of a deficiency in the mind, we may very often bring a certain stigma which is not intended or proper in nature. In a thousand ways, every day, we cheat ourselves a little in some manner or some particular by this identification between body and being. And if we can begin to rescue ourselves from this, life can be much more meaningful and important to us. Now, body brings us with it another interesting question. How did body begin? And here we have a great deal of thought from a philosophical level in India and in other ancient cultures, for that matter, which parallels but does not entirely conform with modern anthropological thinking. Anthropology very largely is concerned with the evolution of man as body. Yet anthropology also realizes that somewhere in that long story of the gradual differentiation of man, there was a point, a time of quickening, some mysterious, intangible moment in space or time where man suddenly seemed to begin to become man. And that prior to that, man was a beast, or a little better than perhaps the most ingenious of the bipeds. But at a certain time, humanity broke through the mysterious barrier of the animal world. And man, the animal, the material form, possessed and dominated only by an instinctive animal nature, changed. And from this organism, there began to blaze out man, the thinker, from whose rudimentary intelligence has been developed all the complicated way of life that we know now. The ancients believed that form as such, bodies as such, began all together and in one general way. They began as the result of spores projected in space, and that all life upon planets began or had its origin in the outer atmosphere of these planets. We have from the balloon experiments of Picard and others come to discover that there are what are called free spores in space. They are minute units of life which, placed into an environment adaptable to themselves, will begin to grow and generate and produce monocellular organisms or structures with one cell for a body. But these spores may have come to the earth, precipitated from space, perhaps as the result of the cooling of a planet and its relationship to the atmospheric area around it. In any event, in the humidity that fell upon the earth, there were spores. And from these, all life on earth, all material forms, had their origin. They were born, therefore, out of the primordial ilus, or slime, described in ancient writings. And even our most remote ancestors, who knew very little bit about evolution, had their ancient records to the effect that men were born out of water and through mud and to the land. And that all life began as a scum upon the surface of water. And that these minute organisms gradually unfolded and complicated through time. Little by little, these forms grew. Division took place within them, but the primordial cell was not divided any more than it is with the human being, whose growing body does not break through the original membrane of the first fecundated cell. And so division took place, cells multiplied, structure began, and little by little, the body of man was built up in the same way that the world was built, step by step and by degrees, through cleavage, through the gradual establishment of zones, first a polar continent and then a subpolar continent, and gradually the cells expanding and extending until we see the gradual emergence of forms as we know them today. But this is the story of bodies. And as these bodies developed, they became vehicles or vehans, drawing to themselves entities suitable to those bodies. And as these bodies became more and more unfolded, higher orders of entities, higher orders of beings, became the masters of these machines. And these higher orders of beings were not only masters of the machines, but they were responsible for them. And the individual is responsible for his body in the vast order of minute life that it develops and unfolds within the body. In time, it is said that those beings which we now call human beings, referred to in the ancient apocryphal book of Enoch as the sons of God, gazed down into the abyss and saw there the forms or bodies, the daughters of men, and descended unto them. And from them was born a race of giants. We have many ancient allegories in the Zohar and in the various glosses to the Old Testament explaining these passages and reminding us that at a certain time, the being that we call man took upon himself the coat of skins and in so doing brought us primordial humanity. And from the time that this being entered into man, man was a human being. But man's humanity was not immediately obvious. And for a great time he traveled on in bodies of varying degrees of development, passing through stages that parallel very closely the anthropoid and other apes. But always it was man the anthropoid. It was not the other kingdom any longer, because within this being, within this body was now a being which had a potential existence as man. And this continued and unfolded through millions of years until we have reached our present estate, in which we have brought the body nearer and nearer constantly to the needs and requirements of the being in the body. Growth of bodies, therefore, is really being fulfilling itself through bodies, and the power or the impulse of the urge behind bodies to evolve is really the urge of being to express. Therefore, evolution is the growth or unfoldment of life with its reflection in bodies. Bodies do not grow. Bodies do not provide the materials which we need for growth. The being unfolding through the body produces the phenomenal appearance of growth. For growth is really being possessing its body. Now, we know, for instance, that a young couple may go out and decide to buy a house. And they look around and they find one that has certain advantages. It's in approximately the right location, approximately the right size. But what young couple, especially what young housewife, will ever move into a house and leave it the way it is? Such a thing is utterly unthinkable. It may have just been painted, but the color is not quite right. It may have just been refurnished, but it will certainly need a new kitchen, or otherwise she simply can't be happy there. And it is the same way with the being in the body. As being moves into body in the process of birth, being begins to modify the individual form. As beings collectively moved into body at the beginning of the human race, they began to modify collectively this structure, causing it to become ever more suitable to the needs of this particular creature. They say that one of the very earliest things that the new occupant did to the house was to put a thumb on it. Man is the only creature that has a thumb that moves against the fingers. With all the other animals that have similar hand-like devices, the thumb is merely another finger. But with man, it is opposed to the fingers because it became an Indian symbolism, the symbol of the man himself, who grew by bringing the thumb into opposition to the fingers, which enabled him to pick things up. And of course, one of the real reasons for evolution is that he should pick up a certain number of things as he goes along, principally and particularly ideas. Among the last that he had desires to handle, by the way. But the being in the house begins to model it, modify it, change it. And as the general stream of mankind individualizes more and more, the individual modifications of bodies will be more and more pronounced, because each one is becoming the instrument for a destined purpose. Now, the collectivity of bodies is also something that's important. With humanity, there is a reservoir of bodies. In other words, there exists in the universe an available supply of material suitable for one purpose only, and that is for the creation of bodies for a certain type of living creature. And incidentally, every time this material is incorporated into a body, it is brought in contact with a being, and it lives in an association with that being over a period of time. Now, we have often noted that some folks like to keep pets, and they'll have a happy cat or a very affectionate dog that has been with them a long time, and the longer that dog is with them, the more intelligent that dog seems to become. The more sympathy and love and attention that is devoted upon it, the more it seems as though that little animal grows. It takes on something of a neo-human quality. It seems to understand us better and better. It seems to sympathize more quickly with our moods, until we finally decide that it's a most intelligent animal. Whether our moods are intelligent or not is not considered. In any event, association does have an effect. And the association of body with the being in it means that body elements and body principles, body energies and body entities, because of these minute lives with their vibrating cores, that these minute particles which are assembled to form body and which separate at the death of body and return to their own natural levels again, they pass through a life cycle through their incorporation into our organisms. And when they are separated again from this human compound and return to their native substances, and this is going on constantly, with someone coming into this world and leaving it every 10 seconds, there is a constant building of the vibratory polarity of the material which is used to build bodies. Thus we are all inheriting, little by little, better materials. Materials that have passed through organisms have become more refined, more vital, more highly attenuated. And thus we are able to create ever more sensitive and responsive vehicles for our manifestation. Bodies in this way also evolve. And the elements evolving in bodies evolve as we do. For man living in a universe, moving through various experiences, grows. And these elements which are within his personality take on the vibratory changes that his consciousness passes through. And when they return to their substances, they are correspondingly more advanced or more attenuated, more subtle in their own vibratory polarities. Thus, by degrees, the collective substance of body is changing. And this changing of body substance is toward attenuation.